I hope that you are all doing well with the pandemic and surviving. There's always a silver lining, you know, with the clouds that come along. And if you've been thinking about who's making money off of this sort of thing, you know, the people selling masks are really making a fortune. And secondly, sales of mouthwash have just gone through the sky because people are tired of smelling their own breath. So those are two things that are looking good. And the third one, if we continue to go on much longer, is people are going to have their ears adjusted and surgery put back because of the mask pulling their ears down. So I hope that you've taken advantage of the times that we don't have to wear the masks and have a little fun with it as we go along. Anyway, wanted to talk to you today about jumping to conclusions. You know, it's you're not. I'm sure you've heard it said that you don't judge a book by its cover, but how many publishers actually believe that? You know, they spend millions and millions of dollars every year on consultants and advisors and photographers to get just the right look on the dust jackets of the books that they're going to publish and sell. Now, for example, I've got over here a whole library of romance novels that you know I'm kidding, of course. But you know the romance novels, how the big muscular men of flowing hair, Fabio is kind of the epitome of it. He looks a lot like I did in my 20s. But other people, the Marlboro man, you know, they're looking for just that look to sell the product. And so first impressions are important, and they say you never get a chance, second chance to make a first impression. But just how quickly should we size up another person? And how quickly should we jump to conclusions about something that we don't have personal knowledge and information about? We didn't witness personally. And how quickly should we judge someone because of some rumors that we've heard about him or her? It's a lot behind the current situation we have in many of our major cities across the country lately, with people protesting and rioting over things that they don't really understand, and that they take out of proportion, they blow out of proportion, and to just try and stir up anarchism across the country, and it's just not a good thing. And most of us are old enough to have made the mistake of jumping to a conclusion about another person or some other matter before we had all the facts, and being embarrassed to discover later that we were wrong. It's a humbling experience, isn't it? I'm sure that many of you share it with me. In principle, the Apostle James warns us about making judgments based on partial information. In this case, what we see with our eyes. Notice, join me if you will, in James 2, verses 1 through 9. James chapter 2, 1 through 9. It says, "My brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. For if there should come into your assembly a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and there should come in a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention to the one wearing the fine clothes and say to him, 'Oh, you sit here and have a good place in the congregation,' you know, and say to the poor man, 'Now you stand over there, or sit here at my footstool and just sit on the floor.' Do not the rich man, excuse me, listen, my beloved," he says, "brethren, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promises to those who love him? But you have dishonored the poor man. Do not the rich oppress you and drag you into courts? Do they not blaspheme the noble name by which you're called? If you really fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself,' and you do well. But if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors." Proverbs 18, verse 13. Proverbs 18:13 says, "He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him." The New Living Translation and the Living Bible both are a little more to the point and clear in this condemnation. The New Living Translation says, spouting off before listening to the facts is both shameful and foolish. Where the Living Bible says, what a shame. Yes, how stupid to decide before knowing the facts. I want to talk with you today about not being too quick in coming to conclusions. And in doing so, I want to focus on one of the most familiar stories, well-known stories in the Bible, the story of Job. But we're not going to discuss and focus much on Job. We're going to take a look at another character in the story whose name was not even mentioned. We're not even told. That's Job's wife, who I'll be referring to as Mrs. Job, for lack of something better. But join me, if you will, in the book of Job. We're going to spend most of our time in the book of Job today with a few brief excursions elsewhere. But Job will be our home base for today. He was a descendant of Aram, the son of Shem, and possibly a contemporary of the patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. Abraham was also a descendant of Shem, but through the line of another of Shem's sons, Arphaxad, and you can check that out in Genesis 11:11. So they were distant cousins, probably. And we begin in Job 1, verses 1 through 3. And it says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. Now, Uz was a land southeast of the Dead Sea. Just to give you an idea of the location. And that man was blameless and upright. Not sinless, notice, but upright. Upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. And also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Once again, the New Living Translation says he was, in fact, the richest person in that entire area. Job's greatness not only consisted of his wealth, though, but also it included, of course, his moral and spiritual qualities. Job's greatness not only was a part of him, but reflected on his whole family. Now, pick the story back up in verse 4, Job 1. Now his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. Moffat and the Septuagint both say that it meant that they were taking turns eating at one another's house. Like, you're coming over to my house this week, next week we'll come to yours, and so forth, and doing that. The Septuagint for verse 4 says, and his sons visiting one another prepared a banquet every day, taking with them their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And we'll continue in verse 5. So it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise up early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. We find out things as parents that our children did, most likely in their teen years, that we didn't know about at the time and probably wouldn't have approved of. I know that that's the case with the one family I'm familiar with, my own. But I didn't know everything that my daughter did, and it's a good thing I didn't. But I prayed for her all during that time anyway, and that's similar to what Job was doing in case his children did a little something out of line. So Job was functioning as a priest for the family, as the head of the household would be in that time. There's a word used here, and it's only used 5 times this way in the Bible, and that's the word cursed. And as we read there, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. The word cursed is translated five times as cursed. They're all in the book of Job. And do you know how else it's translated more than 300 times in the Old Testament? It most often is translated as some variation of blessed, 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 blessing, so forth. It all depends upon the context, which is much the case with much of the Hebrew language. It depends on context of how words are translated in multiple meanings. So now let's look, continue our story here in chapter 1, verse 6, 6 through 19. We'll look at the calamities that befell Job and his wife. Now there was a day when the sons of God came together to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where are you coming?" And Satan answered the Lord, "I've been going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? Have you not made it a hedge around him?" Or Satan says, "Does Job not fear God for nothing? You made a hedge around him. No, nothing can come to harm to him. And his possessions increase, and the work, everything about the work of his hands you bless. Why wouldn't he? But now, verse 11, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he surely will curse you and to your face." And so God gave permission to Satan to do that, and he said, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand, and do what you will, but only don't lay a hand on him, on his person." So Satan went out and did just that. Verse 13, there was a day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabians raided them and took them away. And indeed, they killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." So he lost much of his animal possessions in that stroke. And while he was still speaking, verse 16, also another came along and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone escaped to tell you." 17, while he was still speaking, another came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone escaped to tell you." Well, that was just about wiped him out of his flocks and herds. And now verse 18 came the kicker. While he was still speaking, another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young men, and they're all dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you about it." And Job arose and tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground and worshiped and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. How could Job have had this kind of response? And you look for something realistic. And an explanation, sure, faith had a lot to do with it, but I just wonder, there's one possibility that I'll suggest to you, which I hope you think is a little humorous, and but not to be out of line with this appreciation that we have for Job and his righteousness. But there are differences between men and women. We all know that. And perhaps you've read books. One, for example, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. It approaches the differences between how men and women think and act and the cognition factors and so forth. But frankly, it's pretty abstract. And you had to read the whole book to kind of get the idea of what they were talking about. On a much simpler vein and very much easier to understand was a book that I got. It's called Men Are Like Waffles and Women Are Like Spaghetti. Now, it was much simpler in concept. I read the first two chapters of it and had it down pat and knew that the rest of the book was just going to supplement that. I got it. See, I'm speaking here in generalities, and I know there are exceptions to the rule, so please understand that and know that I know that. But men are, they tend to look at things like a waffle. You got a box here, a little square that things are going with. Work goes here, and play goes here, and home goes here, and who knows how many boxes you've got, but when you pour the syrup in, it stays in those little holes, in those little squares. It doesn't run all over the place unless you just get really carried away with it. They hold what goes in that type of box. Women, on the other hand, are kind of like spaghetti, and the sauce just gets on everything, and the noodles are intertwined, and they just wiggle all around, and they touch one another everywhere. It's like every idea and everything that comes through the door gets somehow mixed in the spaghetti, and whatever happened at 6 o'clock in the morning ties in with something that happened at noon and something that happened at 6 o'clock at night, and it just, everything touches. And so with women, nothing happens in a vacuum or in a box. They tie it together, and that happens. Something happens at church, it spills over at home. Nothing happens in a box for them. Getting back to a little more serious approach of that, maybe the reason why Job was able to keep these terrible events separate and to not lose focus on his relationship with God. That was in a box. That was in a square in the waffle that wasn't going to be touched and wasn't going to be torn down by something else in another part of his waffle. So if you're like me, over the years, you've probably heard over and over a pretty negative explanation of Mrs. Job's role. And how could it be any other way? I question rhetorically. Doesn't she tell God to curse, or tell Job to curse God and die? So was Job's wife a curse or a blessing? Was she a critic or a comfort to him? Like I said, we've heard through the years a rather negative explanation of her role. The Proverbs 18:17 in the Living Bible says, any story sounds true until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight. Another old Indian prayer you may have heard of in the past says, grant that I may not criticize my neighbor until I have walked a mile in his moccasins. So before we're too quick to criticize Job's wife, let's take a little walk in her moccasins, shall we? You know, she's got only one line of dialogue in the whole Bible. It's kind of like a walk-on role with one scene. If you had only one line and one scene to contribute to the Bible, wouldn't you want it to be something memorable, something with deep meaning to give some insight into your condition at the time? Not that she was aware that Job's story and her role in it would be preserved for history as it was, but nevertheless, she had something to contribute in context of what was going on. As another aside, if you don't mind my saying, we used to have variety shows in San Diego, San Diego Church many years ago, and back in worldwide days when we had about 300 people in two congregations, a total of about 600 people. And the North Church was called Escondido, and the South was San Diego. And each year, the Escondido would have a talent show, and we in San Diego would have a variety show. That's because they had all the talent, and we had the variety. And so, no offense to anybody who participated in that back in those times. But we had a fun show one year, and a couple that were in the skit, it was called To Tell the Truth. I don't know if you remember the To Tell the Truth show. If you're very old, you probably do. There would be three contestants that would come on, and say that they were the same person and sit down in a row of a panel of celebrity B-list, C-list, D-list, lower-ranking celebrities, people who are known for bit parts and that sort of thing, ask questions and try to figure out who was the real person. So we had a skit that was had been written by somebody at Ambassador College, and a friend of mine gave me a copy of it. And we decided we would do that. It was just filled with stereotypes of Church of God people and approach to things. To give you an idea, we started out with three men, all of whom would say, I am a member of the Worldwide Church of God, and sat down. The first two did. The third man came in with a briefcase and a Bible and a concordance, and trailing behind him was obviously his wife and two children. And they had a blanket to put down and make a little mat on the floor for the child, the baby, the younger one, to go to sleep during the program. And it was quite hilarious. And there was no woman in the original script, but the lady that we came up with the idea, she said, what if we did this and added the woman and the child, and then it just kind of developed and added to it, and it added even more to the stereotypes. And she came in and she had a part that had no lines, nothing scripted, not even a role in the original script at all, but she came in and stole the show without saying a word. At one point, you know, as soon as she came in, she told her husband, you know, well, there's no extra seats. There are no seats here for us. And so he got somebody that, off the stage to bring out some chairs and sit there for the wife and the older child. And then the baby laid down on the blanket. And then she just sat there and listened. And when the questions would come to her husband, she would tap him on the shoulder and kind of whisper in his ear like she was priming him and giving him the right answers. And at one point, she got the baby up off of the floor and made her way between the table and the chairs where the contestants were sitting, and they had to scoot back to let her through just like she was getting up to go to the mother's room in church. And it was really a hilarious thing. She made the most of that role with just no lines at all, never spoke a word out loud that anybody heard. But that's kind of what I think of when I think of Job's wife in a lighter fashion, in as much as she didn't have much time to say much, and her one line needed to convey her feelings of where she was. So come back to Job's wife and the message that that she conveyed in her one line and in her one scene. And we're starting in Job chapter 2, verses 7 through 10. Job 2, 7 through 10. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, and he took himself a potsherd, that's a piece of broken pottery, with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of ashes. And his wife came to him and said to him, do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. A rather mild rebuke if we take the worst at what she said. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. Let me help you take a little walk in her moccasins. She was married to Job, the greatest and richest of all the men in that region. She too shared in his wealth, his status, his prestige, and likely in his moral and spiritual condition as well. I submit to you that a happy and successful family, and that from all accounts and appearances they seem to have had, just doesn't generally come from a home where there is an angry, bitter, or contentious wife and mother. So I infer from that standing of the family that she was not the bitter woman that we sometimes characterize her as. Five times between Genesis and I forget what that means. I've got an abbreviation. Ephesians. Anyway, we're told that when a married man and a woman, they become married, they become as one flesh. And that's the point that I wanted to make there. As one, we share all the hopes, the dreams, the ambitions, the heights of joy and happiness, but also the depths, the disappointments, the discouragement, the hurts, and the sometimes the suffering of one another. It's not for no good reason that in most marriage vows, there's some reference to for better or for worse. Godly couples pull together under stress and trial, and husbands need the support and affirmation of their wives more than from anyone else. So over the course of several weeks, his condition, that is Job, became so bad that he could no longer live in his own house. And he moved to the city dump, the ash heap, the dung heap. He scraped the boils on his body with a piece of broken pottery. But she suffered each day as he did. Each morning and each night, suffering with and for her husband. She shared in the shame of the accusations against him that his predicament was due to some sin that he committed and wouldn't reveal. Job's wife suffered almost as much as she did, as he did, except for her health. She lost everything too. Her home, her family, her possessions, her position in the community. She didn't just have sympathy for Job. She had empathy. She personally knew and felt much of his pain. Isn't it natural for us to want to relieve the pain and suffering of our loved ones? Even wishing we could take some of the pain on ourselves to bring some relief to those loved ones. Let me read what the Septuagint adds and fleshes out these verses that we just read in Job 2, verses 7 through 10. This is from the Septuagint. So the devil went out from the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from his feet to his head. He took a potsherd to scrape away the discharge and sat among the dung heap outside the city. And when much time had passed, his wife said to him, "How long will you hold out, saying, 'Behold, I will yet wait yet a little while, expecting the hope of my deliverance? For behold, your memorial is abolished from the earth. Even your sons and daughters, the pangs and pains of my womb, which I bore in vain with sorrows. And you yourself sat down to spend the nights in the open air among the corruption of worms. And I am a wanderer and a servant from place to place and house to house, waiting for the sun, setting of the sun, that I may rest from my labors and my pangs, which now beset me. But say some word against the Lord and die." But he looked on her and said to her, "You have spoken like one of the foolish women. If we have received good things from the hand of the Lord, shall we not endure evil things?" The UCG Bible commentary has more to say on this subject as well. Quote, "Once again, Satan comes upon an angelic presentation before God, and God presents him with Job's unswerving devotion. This time, Satan presses the issue by saying that if God will remove his protection and allow him to attack Job's physical health, then Job will reject God as he had predicted. God then allows the devil to cross the line. But demonstrating his power and authority over Satan, he still imposes a limit. Satan is not allowed to kill Job. Yet what Satan is allowed to do, afflict Job with painful boils from head to toe, was no doubt extremely and unrelentingly agonizing. And on top of the psychological pain of losing his family, it must have been all the more excruciating. Still quoting from UCG Bible commentary, Job's wife urges him to, quote, curse God and die, end quote, in verse 9. The word curse here, once again, is the exact same word that's also translated bless throughout the Old Testament, only translated as curse or cursed in the book of Job. Many today imagine her as an impious, unsympathetic, bitter nag, or even that she wanted to get rid of Job, thinking the loss of her children must have been his fault, that he had done something to deserve punishment from God. But it seems more likely that Job's wife, having been so close to him and witnessing unceasing devotion to God, even now, would have perceived him just as God described him, as blameless. I think we should consider that besides losing her family, she was now watching her husband suffer intolerable pain and anguish. It was no doubt difficult for her to understand why God would allow her faithful husband to be stricken. Indeed, it's difficult for most people today to understand it. She may well have been quite angry with God. Moreover, she perhaps said what she did, thinking that Job's illness was terminal anyway, and that he could, with just a few words, find immediate relief from his suffering. But this great man, however, remarks on the foolishness of such a course and remains persistent in his faithfulness. End quote. When she had reached the limit of what she could watch happen to her husband, whom she dearly loved, what she said in verse 9 might well read instead of curse God and die, bless God and die. Young's literal translation, as well as the American Baptist Publication Society and Douye Rheims Bible, say and do translate that as bless God and die. Jusenius' Hebrew and Chaldean lexicon to the Old Testament translates Job 2:9 as bless God and die. So similar to what we read earlier in Proverbs 18:17 in the Living Bible also says that any story sounds true until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight. There's another side to the story of Job's wife. She had endured her husband's affliction, even the loss of all of their children and all of their material possessions, and had survived these trials. Like her husband, she was bewildered amid such calamity. Such a piece of advice as she gave him in his affliction could have been inspired by sympathy and love. Probably she would rather have seen him die than to continue the great suffering that he was going through. Though Job's wife is not mentioned in the closing chapters of the book of Job, we learn in Job 42, verses 10 through 14, Job 42, 10 through 14, that three daughters, Jemima, Keziah, and Karen Hukbuk, as well as sons, were born to him, and God blessed Job with twice the physical blessings he had before. Probably Job's wife arose to new joy just as he did, and regretted her own lack of faith when she advised him to bless God and die. In the end, she was blessed, as was Job, with the physical restoration of the family, wealth, prestige, and relationship with God. The lesson for us today should be obvious. What seems to be one way on the surface at the first glance may not be true. Take the time to get the facts before you come to conclusions. You may save yourself a lot of regret and embarrassment, and quite possibly save the reputation of others by not spreading falsehoods about them.